Hi, it's the Philosopher's Zone, another summer edition. Today, we revisit a philosophy of waste.
We take, we take, we use, we throw away. We take, we take, we use, we throw away. We take, we take, we use, we throw away.
Well, motene is a Japanese word that essentially means what a waste or don't be wasteful. It's sort of a word that the meaning changes from context to context. So if you see somebody throwing away a bundle of excess napkins that they hadn't used, then they might chastise somebody and say, ah, motainai, don't be wasteful. Or if you spill a glass of milk, you might sort of bemoan to yourself, ah, motainai, say, ah, what a waste.
What a waste, what a shame, what you throw away.
Kevin Taylor remembers a household full of exotic items from China and Japan, a particular aesthetic favoured by his mother and grandmother. He went on to study environmental philosophy at grad school, but the influences of his childhood remained, and as it turned out, resurfaced in his study of the Japanese ethic of care, known as motenai.
It's a very common word. I actually just came across one article that listed it amongst the top seven words that represents Japanese-ness, next to words such as gambare, kawaii, and, of course, motenai.
So to the history of it, what is its earliest use? How far back can it be tracked?
In writing, the earliest that it's been tracked so far has been in the Heike Monogatari, or the Record of the Genpei Wars. And in that story, one of the generals, Yoshitsune, is retreating from battle and he drops his bow. He turns around on his horse to go and retrieve the bow, and one of his vassals admonishes him and says, no life is worth a bow, which he uses the word motainai. However, in that particular context, he's returning to pick up the bow because it's a low-quality bow, and he doesn't want his enemies to see such a low-quality bow being used by a general.
That's a record of its earliest use. This is during the Genpei Wars. Whenabouts was that? Is that the 12th, 13th centuries?
Yeah, it was in about the 1200s.
And is there evidence of it being used after that point?
It does come up from time to time. And one of the things that I found interesting about it is everybody seems to have taken for granted that this is a Buddhist word in origin. Most people, when they start writing about this topic, say that motainai has its origins in some Buddhist word, or it's derived from a Buddhist word. But what I have found is no support for that. I have seen examples where Buddhists have used it, but more accurately, it seems to be a Japanese word that has become affiliated with Buddhist context. Some have said that the word had been around from the post-World War II generation and that it was starting to go away. So some of the adults in, I believe it was about 2005, 2003, began to revitalize the word to bring it back because the new generation was beginning to forget the word and the meaning behind it. So it was in the early 2000s that the word began to be revitalized.
So quite a modern reinterpretation or reuse of the word. What about Shinto?
Well, I think that there's a lot of Shinto evident in the use of the word. Motainai essentially means this feeling of regret for the loss of the intrinsic value of an object. And you see a lot of reverence for objects in Japanese culture, whether it's teapots or calligraphy brushes or Japanese katana. And with motainai, you can see that being extended to everyday household objects, such as umbrellas, pencil cases, shoji, the sliding wall screens. Insofar as Japanese culture does seem to have a reverence for objects, I see a connection with motainai there as well. And part of the reason for that is because of the idea of animism in Shinto, that spirits or gods or deities can sometimes inhabit physical objects. One story tells of a monster or spirit called a tsukumogami, and a tsukumogami is essentially an everyday object that has been around for about 100 years, and it develops or it grows a spirit, a kami, in it. And after 100 years, this object might come to life. So one of the implications to this is that if you're not treating your objects well, the spirits may become tsukumogami in these objects and come back to make you regret treating them so badly.
Mm. So is it a case of having a reverence or understanding that perhaps objects have a spiritual dimension, or is it about a sense of humility, a kind of a larger sense of humility towards the environment, or is it a case of both?
I think it's a case of both. There seem to be a lot of confluences that come together with this term. There's the reverence for the objects because Japan, as we know, is an island nation with limited resources. So if something breaks, it may have taken a long time to get some objects replaced. Post-World War II was very resource-deprived, so you had to make the most of what you had. With regards to humility and respect for nature, Japan also has the notion of being a very green country, a very environmentally friendly country, and the love for nature, either with the cherry blossoms or moon viewings or the love of Japanese mountains, sort of extend to this notion of motainai, that you should appreciate nature and respect it as such, and therefore do your best to keep it pure and clean, or to use it to its potential.
Mm. Interesting you mentioned island cultures. Do you think this is specifically so for Japan, that being an island, it does underscore some of these ideas, some of these philosophical ideas?
Definitely early on, being an island nation had some influence over resource scarcity, trade with other countries, especially at points when trade with other countries was much more limited and they had to rely on the produce that they grew, the animals that they had, or their international trade. I think it's probably less so after the World War II generation, after the economic boom. One of the reasons that the current generation has been trying to revitalize this notion of motainai spirit amongst Japanese is the idea that Japan has become more wasteful or more prone to pollution, or having certain industrial problems. So part of the idea of revitalizing it is to sort of go back to that mentality where the resources are more appreciated and the full uses gotten out of these objects.
Well, in modern times, it appears that 2002 was a watershed year. There was a white paper put out called Recycling Society, where I think the Japanese government was trying to get citizens to understand the amount of rubbish that's created annually. I think something like 50 million tons plus of garbage annually that needed to be taken care of. And also around that same time, there were articles about how the citizenry ought to reuse materials.
I think that it was definitely an important time. A lot of the references tend to go towards 2005 with Wangari Maathai, but the truth is that motainai was becoming popularized in the early 2000s before her arrival. Student movements were trying to popularize the word, and the book Motainai Grandmother was published a year before Wangari Maathai arrived. Now, when she arrives in 2005, under the invitation from the Japanese Prime Minister for the Kyoto Protocol, she discovers the word and begins to popularize it. So while a lot of people point to 2005 as the watershed, I would say that it was actually happening much earlier than that, and she brought it global.
Just tell me a little bit more about Wangari Maathai and how she got involved.
Wangari Maathai is a Kenyan environmentalist, advocate, women's right advocate, famous conservationist, professor from Kenya. She won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2004 for some of her efforts. So because she had been making such good movements in the conservation movement, she was invited to Japan for the Kyoto Protocol. And when she discovered the word, she liked it and equated it to the fourth R in recycle, reduce, reuse, and she termed it respect. So she was bringing back the reverence for objects, or the respect to nature, that Japan was beginning to see missing. She had previously said that this was a word that she was sort of looking for in some other culture, and that she didn't find it anywhere until her arrival in Japan, and she immediately fell in love with it and immediately began to try to popularize it.
Mm. Interestingly, you did mention there that even before she came on the scene, there was it Motainai Grandma?
A famous author of Japan wanting to remind children of this post-World War II mentality, this frugality that was being lost, published Motainai Grandma, and it's very telling that it was actually the grandmother, because that's from the generation that was believed to last be using this principle. So she introduces this cartoon character, Motainai Grandma, and as you go through the children's book, she's basically talking to her granddaughter, and she'll see her wasting some rice and scold her and say, Motainai, eat all of your rice. Whereas, you know, maybe in the United States or in Australia, we might say, think of the starving children in such and such countries, and you try to get them to think, oh, well, I'm privileged and I should, you know, finish my my meal. The approach being taken in that case is saying, well, a lot of people went to a lot of effort to put this food on your table, and you should show them proper respect and eat everything that's been given to you and not waste it. But elsewhere in the book, she'll show that instead of throwing away a sweater, you can repurpose it. Or if you're sitting around wasting your time, there are other things that you can do, such as making snow angels or enjoying the scenery.
Mm. So from your observation and research, how much is that way of thinking part of the society?
Well, it's been suggested that the word is fairly popular and that most people, you know, probably 80% of the population know the word or understand the connotations with it. The question of how it's actually employed is always a very difficult question when you do come from a culture that has a lot of food waste, that has a lot of individually packaged items that are inside of larger packaged items. So to combat this, the idea of Motainai is sort of a grassroots popularized movement that has been taken up by the Japanese Ministry of the Environment is still something that is, it's still at odds to some extent to the consumer culture that is in fact very wasteful.
Kevin Taylor on his close study of the idea of Motainai as a way of approaching environmental challenges. Our guest today on the Philosopher's Zone. So, you talk about a grain of rice not being wasted. It seems very much connected popularly with food.
I think so. One of the issues that Japan has is with a large amount of food waste, as you had mentioned earlier. And I think that Motainai, which has frequently been said to be Buddhist in origin, has a really good direction that it can go with if they continue emphasizing these Buddhist aspects. Buddhism already has a food ethic in it. It's typically thought that Buddhism and Japanese Buddhism is vegetarian, and it's typically thought that there is frugality in Buddhism. So it seems to be a natural fit that Motainai could work especially well for Japanese Buddhist food ethics.
Mm. So what are those food ethics? How does it interrelate? Because obviously there would be a rich history in that.
So normally Japanese Buddhism is thought that its food ethic, if you think of it as having one, probably begins and ends with the notion that it's a vegetarian ethic. And that's another one of those ideas that needs to be contextualized a little bit. Because Buddhism, when it comes out of India, actually has listed within its parameters certain foods that are allowed and meat is included. And it's not until it enters into China and begins to have a relationship with Taoism that certain practices of meat avoidance begin to become incorporated with it. So as Buddhism leaves India, crosses through China and into Japan, the ethic begins to change from one that had this amount of frugality associated with it to certain rituals that get adopted from Taoism, that certain meats are to be avoided at certain times and certain alcohols are not permitted, you know, under various purification ritual reasons. When Buddhism begins to enter into Japan, it carries some of these vegetarian notions with it, but a lot of the reason that they stick is because there are certain practices already in place in Japan. But even this begins to change, and notions of vegetarianism basically begin to wax and wane. And it's not until Zen Master Dogen writes in his book, Instructions for the Cook, that he begins to focus more on the food culture in Zen Buddhism. And what he begins to do is to actually introduce a form of Chinese food ethic into Japanese Zen.
Does that relate to the spirit of Motainai in that it's not necessarily about waste, it's about what you eat and how you eat it? Is there a connection between that food moral culture and the Motainai ontology of respect, humility, and not wasting?
Yeah, I would say that with the idea of Motainai, it would really depend from one Buddhist practitioner to another, from one person to another, as to whether or not a vegetarian diet, it would be implied in something like Motainai. And I would argue that it's not. When we talk about Buddhist practices in Japan, we actually have to say who's Buddhism. So you might have Soto Zen or Rinzai Zen or Pure Land or True Pure Land or Nichiren. And even then, from one temple to another, you'll have a wide variety of different practices. So you're not necessarily even asking which sect of Buddhism in Japan, but you're asking which teacher of which sect are they teaching. So in some cases, you'll see people saying, well, the principle of suffering or ahimsa prevents us from eating animals. So we want to reduce suffering in the world. So part of the Motainai aspect would be folded into that and say, well, we have to respect the intrinsic nature of the animals and their life, and therefore subscribe to a vegetarian diet. I think you can make the opposite argument, though, that if we eat these animals, what is most important is that we show reverence and respect for the meat that we are eating by not wasting it.
And there's also the karmic influence as well, isn't there? The idea that, you know, perhaps you may be killing and eating a spirit that has come back.
Yeah, and particularly in Dogen's time, when they're talking about the karmic implications, Buddhism, of course, comes with the idea of reincarnation. Sometimes it gets focused and sometimes it doesn't. But in Japanese Buddhism, when someone dies, they could be reborn as an animal. So one of the dissuasive arguments for, you know, why you shouldn't eat animals is because this might have been someone who was related to you in a former life, and you don't want to eat your relatives. Conversely, you also don't want to treat them special because they are burning off a certain amount of karmic debt. So ultimately what you get is that you need to treat animals like animals. And a lot of these practices, the ideas of eating these animals would basically be written off as, no, this is a karmic rebirth and you might not want to risk that.
So back to this question of everyday objects and items and being imbued with something special that needs to be respected. There are toy hospitals in Japan, aren't there?
Yes, there are.
And they very much would cut to this idea of Motenai or the Motenai spirit.
Right. So a lot of the toys that we get nowadays, when you open them and take them out of the box, if you were to break them, you would either keep playing with a broken toy or you would throw it away because it's broken. You know, because a lot of these products aren't made in such a way that they can be easily repaired. You can't simply take out a couple of tools, you know, swap out a couple of parts and fix them. So since this Motainai is either respect for the intrinsic value of these objects, or it's a conservationist or a frugal sort of ethic, one expression of this is with these toy hospitals where broken toys are taken in and specialists or people who know a little something about repairing these toys and have the appropriate tools will take them and basically show the child, you know, this is where the damage is and this is what we're going to do to fix it. Or if they don't have the capabilities present to fix those objects, they might say, well, he's going to have to stay in intensive care for a little while until we get the parts in, and then we can return him home after that. And part of what they're doing is emphasizing that just because it's broken doesn't mean that we throw it away. This is something that can still give you joy.
Mm. And just finally, you're doing some research on a Zen master. Tell me about how that fits in with this quest to understand Motenai in a wider perspective.
Yeah, I'm currently doing research on Zen master Hakuin, and he's a 17th century Zen master. And it's an interesting time period to be doing this research because it's starting to become more modern. He essentially lives on the border of a larger city, so he's having experiences with the rural life as well as with urban life. One of the reasons that I'm focusing on him is because he was a revitalizer of Rinzai Zen during a period of stagnation that essentially Zen was looked very down upon by the populace. A lot of these Zen masters were, according to Hakuin, either fakes or mooching off society. They would go into their temples, remove themselves from everybody else, live off of donations, and practice in relative seclusion from the rest of the world. So one of the things that he criticizes in trying to make his form of Zen popular again is that this is not do-nothing Zen. This is engaged Zen. And one of the reasons that I'm focusing on this particular character is because of the recent success with engaged Buddhism, popularized especially by Thich Nhat Hanh and several other people who are studying Buddhism and ecology movements. So Hakuin, in successfully popularizing his form of Zen, focused on koan practice, which would be the what is the sound of one hand clapping, or does a dog have Buddha nature? These koans are riddles or stories, and his practice is to essentially wrestle with these koans, not just when you're sitting in meditation, which he does do, but when you take it with you in everyday life. So if you're going out into the city, or if you're teaching other people, then you are supposed to be thinking about these koans until you finally have an answer, and then you move on to the next one. Now, one of the reasons why I'm interested in Hakuin is because he's taking this idea of koans and meditation in the midst of activity and bringing them into everyday life. The idea is that it is essentially a psychological orientation, that the koan makes you think and be a different way as you're getting into deeper and deeper levels of insight. And one of the things that this insight does is it's an increased awareness into the interconnectedness of everything. It's one of the core Buddhist philosophy, this idea of pratichasamutpada. It's the interconnectedness of everything. So through koan practice and meditation, Hakuin essentially is telling us that we are becoming aware that everything in the world is interconnected. So if I am beginning to waste paper, it's a popular example used by Thich Nhat Hanh, that if you hold up a piece of paper, he will ask, can you see the sun in this? And of course the answer is, well, the sun gives light to the trees, which helps the tree grow, and we turn the tree into paper, which we therefore use. So I can see myself, and I can see the sun in this piece of paper, and I can see how everything is interpenetrating. So in focusing on Hakuin and his form of practice, I'm essentially seeing a form of proto-engaged Buddhism in 17th century Japanese Zen. And what he managed to successfully do was popularize it and revitalize it during a period of stagnation. So one of the things that Zen propounds to do is to actually increase awareness. And one of the problems that environmentalism has often is, how do we increase environmental awareness? And what I'm hoping in this research to find is, can I find the mechanism in koan meditation, extract that, and put that into environmental action?
Well, you probably have almost answered my next question, but let me put it to you. I'd imagine you've been trained in Western scholarship and Western philosophy.
Yes.
Why this interest to you?
That is a harder question to answer. I can tell you that for as long as I can remember, I have actually been interested in Japanese culture. When I do think about that, I realize that as a child, I was surrounded by various elements of Chinese and Japanese culture from both my mother and my grandmother. These were sort of elements that were in the house, things that a particular aesthetic that, you know, our family just naturally gravitated towards. And when I began to go into graduate school, I knew that I wanted to continue that, but I also wanted to work on environmental philosophy or environmental history or some form of environmental action. And I didn't quite know how to bridge the two. And slowly but surely, as I had studied more and more of each, I began seeing that the one thing that environmental philosophy and Buddhist philosophy have in common is this shared vocabulary with interconnectedness. And through there, I've been able to see all the different ways that these have been able to be utilized. And of course, when one studies Japanese Buddhism, there's more than just philosophy. There's culture, there's history, there's language, there's all these other different elements. So if I get to a certain point in my research in Japanese Buddhism, there's this other thing that pops up that catches my attention. If you get tired of delving too deeply into philosophical concepts, then all of a sudden stories about monsters and reincarnation come up, and those are just extremely entertaining.
I think that's a very good answer. I have to say I'm most entertained by a lot of those stories.
It is fantastic.
Kevin Taylor, thank you very much. Good luck with your work, and thank you for being on The Philosopher's Zone.
Thank you very much. We throw away.
Kevin Taylor, working towards publishing an in-depth study of Motunai, and he is at Southern Illinois University. Today's Frugal Edition was brought to you with the help of Andrei Shabanov. More highlights over summer next week. I'm Joe Gelonesi. See you then.